I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today we're going to be talking about, I think it's a subject that everybody knows something about, everybody feels something about, and that is the question of how to be human in a disconnected world, a world that seems ever more disconnected, the impact of technology on our human experience, the history, a little bit of the history of that, and where we are in contemporary American society. And we're joined for the conversation today by someone who knows all about this. She is Christine Rosen. She has written a wonderful book that I have to recommend so highly to our listeners, The Extinction of Experience, Being Human in a Disconnected World. Christine is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. She's also a columnist for Commentary Magazine and a host of Commentary's podcast. You'll want to check out the magazine. Wonderful commentary is always good. The podcast is terrific. Christine, thanks for joining us on The American Idea.
Thanks so much, Jeff. I'm glad to be here.
All right. The title of the book is Extinction of Experience, Being Human in a Disconnected World. It's an amazing fact to me that the world has never seemed more connected. The world is flat, as famously was proclaimed. Shouldn't we be more connected?
Well, that was certainly the hope and the ideal when first the internet and then later platforms that encourage connection through social media, for example, were created. It was the promise. It's still the promise if you're a Silicon Valley true believer. But I think what it didn't take into account are some hard-learned truths and realities about things such as human nature and human behavior and the kinds of incentive structures that were built into some of these platforms and what they bring out in us. Now, that's not to say that people can't find connection online. Most of us use these forms of technology every day. But I think what was striking to me after having studied this stuff for many decades, I started studying early social networks before Facebook when MySpace was the rage. So that's how old I am.
It's been a while.
So what always concerned me was what kinds of behaviors, what kinds of connections were these platforms encouraging by their design? And what were some of the likely unintended consequences? And I think what we see now many decades later is that that hope for connection failed to take into account that actually human beings are meant to do most of their long-term social connections in particular face-to-face with smaller groups of people. And what we did is move a lot of those sorts of interaction online without thinking through what we might lose while doing that. And so we're now kind of dealing with the wreckage of that in politics and culture and family life. And I think we're now starting to ask very important questions, which couldn't come at a better time because these problems will persist unless we start thinking through solutions.
Take us a little bit more through the argument of your book itself.
So I chose a rather portentous sounding title with extinction in it because I actually started cataloging some of the experiences in daily life, just very quotidian, everyday things that I noticed were either changing dramatically, not for the better, or were disappearing entirely. And one of the things that really struck me about the way that most of us, many of us, live our lives now, whether it's our leisure time, our work and our leisure time, the way our children are educated, is that we're doing it in mediated ways. That allows us to avoid some of these things we know because of what our physical bodies have taught us over the years. So less physically embodied, more screen-based, more information about things rather than direct experience of doing them. So that's why I borrowed the phrase extinction of experience from a naturalist named Robert Michael Pyle. He was very concerned many, many decades ago watching young children who didn't play outside. He worried that if they didn't have this experience of being out in nature and seeing wildlife and plant life, that they wouldn't understand what it meant if, say, a species went extinct, because they never had the direct experience in the first place. And that really resonated with me and got me thinking about how we have in our digital lives done something similar in terms of removing those hands-on, face-to-face direct experiences in our daily lives.
I think there are some people, I have a 19-year-old son, I have a 13-year-old daughter, clearly, as they say, digital natives. There are some people who say, isn't this, you're still a young person, but isn't this an old fogey argument? Haven't we heard this generations and generations? Technology is changing everything. Technology is uprooting everything. What's different about the current technology?
Yes, I happily embrace the label of old lady shouting at clouds. I'm Gen X, so I grew up without a lot of these tools and had to adapt to them as an adult. I hope that gives me a little bit of healthy cynicism, but also the experience of comparing and contrasting how things were done. I have 18-year-old children, so I've also watched them come through a process of childhood very different from my own. And while I hope I don't sound like too much of a curmudgeon, I think I can make a pretty sustained argument about the quality and quantity here. Every new technology sparks moral panics, concerns, outrage. I mean, comic books were going to threaten society. When women were reading novels, it was going to be the destruction of society. I definitely understand that reaction. What's different here is that the amount of time we spend mediating our daily experiences. The average person spends 7 or 8 hours a day looking at a screen. It's much higher if you're younger, or if you're one of those digital natives. Also, the number of things we do via the screen, it isn't just at work, it isn't just at school, it's all of our free time, it's every moment of interstitial time throughout the day, we are reaching for a screen, we are staring at a screen, we are tuning out from our physical surroundings. So the quality of those experiences change. The quantity of our embodied physical face-to-face real world experiences shrinks. And so our skill set, dealing with impatience, dealing with having to wait for things, having to deal with difficult other human beings. We don't have to do that anymore, which means we don't have to practice those skills. So, and the third thing is that the intimacy of these technologies and their ability to track our physical reactions to things in real time, the amount of information they can glean about us, even without us realizing it, all of that makes this a somewhat significant shift from earlier personal technologies.
In the book, you talk about the effect on the experience that we have, or the extinction of experience that we have in various areas of life. So, for example, the family, our social connections, our workplace, education. Can you talk about some of the ways in which experience is being extinguished, important experience is being extinguished in those areas?
So I think the most important thing throughout all of those areas that we're losing because we're not practicing it is the face-to-face interaction. So I interviewed lots of people who hire, you know, like recent college graduates, people who work in retail environments where, you know, you have a public-facing role standing behind a cash register or selling clothing or something. And one consistent thing I heard from all of these people was that each younger generation that they had to train in these roles needed to do a lot of remedial skill work in basic things like looking people in the eye, carrying on polite conversation, dealing with an increasingly impatient customer base, and just keeping the polite attention of the people who they were serving, whether they were, you know, waiters in a restaurant or whether they were professors at a university with an incoming class of freshmen. And what that suggests is that we have been forming, all of us, and I include my generation in this too because of how much we use these tools, habits of mind, daily behaviors that start to accumulate. And so we see that in social space when you see how people behave in public, when something is disruptive to their little bubble on their screen that they're looking at, how they react. We see this in rising rates of road rage, the development of air rage, all this sort of cultural impatience. We see it in the tone of our politics. And then inside the home, I think what we find are parents really struggling with how to get those devices out of their hands of their kids, set rules, set boundaries, when so much of the kids' life at school and socially is now funneled through this device. And wonderful work by social scientists like Jean Twenge and John Haidt, whose recent book is fantastic, have shown that we now have evidence of the mental health harm in particular. I would add that there's a harm to just the daily habits of family life, of social life, of public life, of civic life. We're out of practice because we always have this alternative in our pocket.
It's been documented the increase in mental health problems, particularly in adolescence, because of the disconnection and perhaps the hyperconnection simultaneous with human disconnection. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. And this, I would point all of your listeners to Jonathan Haidt's Anxious Generation book, which is well worth reading. I remember decades ago when the first social media was coming online, and Facebook in particular, a lot of us were worried about some of the behavioral science that they were using to structure these platforms. And although they had an age limit, they were required by law to have one. It was clearly not something that was ever going to be enforced either by the government or by these companies. So the question of what it does to children when it, again, the architecture, the design of the platform is meant to reward only attention. And what are the things from human nature that capture our attention? What are we hardwired biologically to respond to? Fear, anger, anxiety. So when you have adults even trying to deal with these emotions and with what they see on the screen and being encouraged at every moment with a like button, with a retweet, everything, react in instant, every moment to every new thing. And because humans love new things, we keep coming back for more. There's an intermittent reward system built into these platforms. So for children who are never practicing daily habits of mind that teach them patience to sit and feel those uncomfortable feelings of anger or frustration, these platforms become very dangerous to their development and growth. And that's what Haidt finally had decades of research to show that. But there were concerns raised at the very beginning about this by lots of people who, all of us were called Luddites, but people like Sherry Turkle from MIT, who's long studied computer-human interaction. So I think that what this tells us going forward, particularly with a lot of the hype we hear now around artificial intelligence, sort of chatbots, the AI agents and whatnot, is that we should always ask these questions at the beginning. We shouldn't assume that the marketing of Silicon Valley tech companies is going to actually have our best interests at heart. We should ask these tough questions. What will this disrupt? What does this bring into my family life that might be might undermine our values, not just connect us to new people? So these questions we're now asking about social media because we see its impact, because it rewards behavior that isn't good for us. So we have to really think every time we bring a new technology, a new power, a new tool into our lives, both what are the good things that are promised, but also what are the potential harms?
And it does seem to me, as a professor and someone who deals with, 20-year-olds all the time, it's really interesting to me to see the social effects and also the educational effects. And I wonder if you could say a little bit more about the educational effects, because my experience is that education, real education, not just downloading information, but real education and thinking requires a personal intimacy of some kind, a real connection between students and with students and professor or teacher. What's the educational impact of the situation?
Well, for all of us who do any form of teaching, the first and most harsh lesson we learn is that there's no way we can compete with those little screens. There's nothing we can do. I mean, I could be turning cartwheels on the desk at the front of the lecture hall. There's still something that's better on YouTube or TikTok that they could watch. So I think the first and most important thing is to ask, okay, how do we want to structure classrooms so that we limit those distractions for students? And one of the fascinating things I dove into a little bit in the book was, and in part, I had skin in the game because I was about to send my sons off to college for their first year of college. And I, of course, always experimented on them. So I said, when you go to a lecture class, take your laptop and take notes for 1 week. And then the next week, take notes by hand. See if you remember things differently. Because it turns out there's this vast body of research about handwriting and memory and retention and cognition, embodied cognition, that says we are designed to remember things more when we slow down our bodies and write by hand and summarize in real time than if we just sit there, because we can type quicker than we can write by hand, than if we just try to do a sort of moment by moment dictation of what's being said. So it's fascinating to realize that some of the old tools, the old school analog ways of doing things, a lecture with a small group of people and everybody's focused on the teacher, no screens are distracting, they're jotting notes by hand. Your students are going to remember more about that lecture than they are if they all have their laptops out. So I know I have a lot of friends who've banned laptops from their seminars. I think the face-to-face Socratic back and forth that a good teacher always does with his or her students, that's becoming more popular. And unfortunately, in the era of ChatGPT, I have a couple of friends who now only do exams with old blue books. Remember those?
I do,
it's
yeah.
The only way to make sure that these students who, again, there's nothing wrong with their eagerness to try new tools. But if we have an entire generation that thinks writing starts with a ChatGPT summary, we're raising a generation of editors, not writers. They have to have that struggle of organizing their thoughts and putting them on paper. So all of these old ways of doing things turn out to have some value that I think we set aside too quickly in the digital era.
It's fascinating you say that, because my experience has been with students also to have them pause and read out loud in class.
Yes.
An experience that they have really never had. They have almost no experience with oral culture.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of approach, and they begin to hear things and sense things and experience things with oral language that sinks in a way that it would certainly never otherwise on a screen.
Well, one of the examples I give in the book that was really striking and speaks exactly to this is that you're not just teaching them to speak and you're teaching them to slow down. And so much of their world is instantaneous now, immediacy. And there's an art historian at a college that she sends her students to the museum and makes them pick one painting or one sculpture and just spend, I think she started out 6 hours total, not all at once, but like they had to spend 6 hours with this work of art just looking, not writing, not analyzing, not coming up with their important thoughts, not looking for the Wikipedia entry on the painting, just sit and look. And it was very difficult for them, but at the end, hugely rewarding to realize that every time they sat and looked, they saw something new. And all of this speaks to a humility about the great work that human beings have left us and that we should respect and treat with awe, the awe that it deserves, whether that's a great piece of literature or writing or wonderful piece of music or art. So all of those things teach, slow down, really look, try to understand, because now they have the immediacy of instant information, but they lack the understanding because they don't take the time.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to take a moment and ask you to learn a little more about the Ashbrook Center and how you can help us continue our work with teachers, students, and citizens.
I'm Chad Kiefer, Director of Philanthropy and Strategic Partnerships here at Ashbrook. At its heart, America's story is about the lives of patriots who have given their last full measure of devotion to preserve and protect what it means to be an American. But the tragic truth is that the American story is being rewritten as one of oppression and despair. Back in 1776, the founders took a chance when they created a new government built on principles of liberty. They took a chance on America. Now I'm challenging you to do the same. Your gift to Ashbrook today reaches students, teachers, and citizens across the country, helping them to understand why America is worthy of their devotion. With so many forces eroding our history and taking away from our principles, isn't it time we give America a chance? Your investment is encouraged now more than ever. Please visit us today at ashbrook.org/support.
You talked a little bit about family life. What about pre-family life, by which I mean romance and people coming together in romantic relationships and forming families? What's the state of play now in this disconnected world?
It's kind of grim. I will say that I one of the first assignments I gave myself when a group of us who founded a tech journal called The New Atlantis, they wanted to write all these thoughtful, very deeply political philosophy pieces about, you know, the ethics of this or the feng shui of that. And all of those were great. I was fascinated by what all my friends were doing, which is they were all on the early internet dating sites. And how those were structured, what kind of behavior was the rewards and incentives for built into these platforms. Those have now become obviously the apps and all the stuff that everybody does on their phones. I will say this, I have lots of friends who have long, healthy, flourishing marriages who met on things like Catholic dating services, Jewish dating services, I only date vegetarians. I will never date a vegetarian. You know, people who self-select very radically at the beginning can have good luck using these tools. What it has done for a lot of other people, though, for young men and women, is that it serves up this idea of an endless number of options. So even if you settle on someone, there's always this idea that, you know, there's 50 more people in my area who meet my criteria. It forces them to perform themselves and market themselves in a way that has become so normalized for their generation that they fail to see what it makes them do. You know, they have to list all of their qualifications, list all their likes and dislikes, pose for photos that make them look more attractive. It's a very outer directed way of approaching another person. And then finally, once they actually finally meet a person after chatting back and forth on an app, they know so much already that very slow back and forth getting to know someone process, and you know they've already Googled them to make sure there's no information about them, that back and forth process has already revealed so much at the beginning that people are prone to cut their losses and move on at the first thing that doesn't quite sit with them right. So I think it's made them romantically impatient, while at the same time thinking there are endless options and choices when they're not, and just less general tolerance for the quirks of other human beings and the slow revealing that I think a good relationship requires as people, you know, there's a give and take that they miss. So all of those things, and then to say nothing of the whole discussion of how pornography has shaped some of their expectations for sexual relations, which has been very damaging to men and women. So it's a challenge. And I think we see this reflected in a lot of the data about how many young people are delaying marriage, saying they never want to be married, saying they never want to form families. So this is all part, again, this is a culture shaping shift. Digital technology is not the only thing to blame, but it definitely plays a role here.
What about the workplace? Because some people might say, well, work, you have to go to work. The workplace can discipline the social media culture and can connect people and force people to be connected because they're in a common organization. They have to show up if they go to work, they have to show up to work. Is that true? Do we see that? Or do we see the same kinds of problems, vices, and difficulties in the workplace?
I think two things are happening in the workplace that are fascinating to me. And as I'm a conservative-leaning person, they both concern me for different reasons. One is that I think a lot of people in the workplace are not the endless exchange of emails and Zoom calls and Zoom meetings. A lot of mediated interaction has made it more difficult and inefficient for people to get things done, as well as channels like Slack and other internal social platforms that are used in workplaces where gossip happens. And actually things that help a workplace have a culture are now mediated and online. And that shapes how people interact. We've seen this in, I know, some media cultures where it's been very harmful because there's something called the online disinhibition effect. You will say and do things through a screen that you would never do face to face. And that might have terrible repercussions, and I think it has politically. But imagine in a workplace where the person's two floors down, but you don't see them, you don't have to interact with them, and you can put something on Slack that's quite horrifying. You would never say it to their face, but they're still part of your workplace culture. So there's that. There's also then the tendency and the desire on the part of employers to use surveillance technologies on their employees. And these are now quite sophisticated. The badges that a lot of people wear track much more than just, you know, where you go throughout the building. It can track how many times you speak in a meeting. It can track how many steps you take throughout a day. So these sensors are becoming very sophisticated. And I think employees are owed a certain amount of privacy, even when they are in the workplace. I don't think an employer needs to know my heart rate throughout the day. What would they do with that information? But there are places that are monitoring their employees in this way. So employees need to ask questions about the amount of information their employers are gleaning about their daily lives.
And what about the question? I've heard some folks argue that for the productivity that comes from creative interaction, getting in a room and brainstorming on a project with your fellows, that is that being recognized as a particular value in the workplace and continuing, or is that also being affected by the disconnection?
I think there has been some impact there, and we've seen particularly after the pandemic time when a lot of people's work moved online, there's been a hesitation on the part of some employers to get employees back in the office, saying, oh, they want more flexibility, they want to work from home. And I've had these fascinating debates about the work from home issue now, and employers really wanting people back in the workplace, but not knowing how to articulate that. But one thing we do see, study after study, is that those serendipitous interactions are hugely important. Pixar, for example, designed its offices so that the guy from accounting was forced to bump into someone from the animation studio because they had to all pass through a common courtyard. Now, you might think 9 times out of 10, that's not going to lead to anything. But it's that one spark where someone with one idea from one division bumps into someone else, they start chatting, and that's where creativity happens. One of the things we should understand about a lot of these technological tools that claim to make our lives more creative, more serendipitous, is that actually they're trying to manufacture serendipity. And that is an oxymoron. The old head of Google, Eric Schmidt, said that in an interview once. He said, we're going to be able to manufacture serendipity. It cannot be manufactured. That's the whole point. But we have to give ourselves opportunities to experience it, whether it's in the workplace, bumping into someone, or even if you're out in public space, bumping into, you know, someone you don't know yet, but might be your next friend, as they like to say. So I think all of these are ways that human beings creativity is sparked. Also, the fallow time our minds need to mind wander and daydream. Those are lost when every free moment goes straight to the phone.
Well, in thinking about the kind of vices and disconnection you're talking about, my mind immediately goes to someone like Tocqueville, who argued the importance of associational life in a democratic society, particularly in American democracy. And I wonder what effect, and if people are looking at the effect that this is having on associational life.
Well, you know, one of the things I've written about, I don't think I include in the book, but I have written about it before, are platforms like Nextdoor. So these online neighborhood platforms that say, we're going to connect all the neighbors and you have
My wife is on Nextdoor.
Yes, I'm on Nextdoor as well. And for the most part, when it's just dealing with logistics, like letting people know about someone's garage sale or letting someone know about a pothole, it's all perfectly fine. But what we also see happening with a lot of these platforms is that the day-to-day face-to-face interactions that neighbors used to have with each other also move online. And so what I've seen play out, I live in a city, so what I've seen is people taking pictures of strangers in the neighborhood, posting it on Nextdoor and going, is this person up to no good in our neighborhood? You know, I was like, what are you talking about? That's like the plumber who comes going to her house. I knew it was my neighbor's plumber. But again, the kind of suspicion and the distance that's created by these platforms gives people a new sort of power, and they like to use it for ill and well, as well as for good. So when you think about sociologists and the 20th century, like Robert Putnam and others who worried about the decline of these third places and sort of bowling leagues and the places where people could associate outside of work, outside of home, but were really the glue, as you say, for democratic and civic health. Those have all, many of them have moved online. And one of the arguments I make in the book is that we need to move more of those back into the real world. That's where stuff happens. That's where we need to connect. That's where we have the kinds of interactions that let us understand that we can disagree with each other, but we're all still in this together.
Probably a lot of people are thinking, you've mentioned politics and the effect of on politics. Probably a lot of people are thinking, could it get any more toxic? And is that connected to this disconnection that you're talking about?
Yes, I don't go in too much into politics in the book since I have to spend a lot of my working day dealing with politics, but absolutely. And again, it speaks to how these platforms are structured, what they reward, what they encourage in terms of our behavior. And then looking at our system, which was designed brilliantly by our founders to build in delay, negotiation, compromise, 3 branches of government that all kind of have to compete and have some powers, but there's going to be arguments about who does what when. And that's how they designed it, because they understood that a deep understanding of human nature. People who design our social media platforms and a lot of our internet platforms and apps like TikTok, they also understand human nature. But what they are doing is trying to exploit the worst parts of our nature. What the founders understood is that, yeah, we have those parts. So how do we design a system of government that tamps that down a little bit, where factionalism and potential revolutionary sort of behavior is at a minimum? So those contracts, that's when our politics plays out online. You think about all the congressmen and senators and elected officials, left and right, this is a bipartisan problem. They get rewarded on these platforms with attention. And so then they start to see themselves as having followers, not constituents. And that's a real distinction that I think we have to discourage. And the only way to discourage that is to stop giving the ones who are seeking our attention the attention they want. And really, again, moving things back into the analog physical world where the negotiating happens and where honestly, one thing we could do is take cameras out of committee hearings. That's a very simple thing you could do in Congress that would eliminate a lot of the grandstanding that turns into a 2-second viral TikTok clip. So these platforms are rewarding a kind of performative politics that has not helped us get things done.
I think a lot of our listeners are thinking to themselves, look, the title of the book, Extinction of Experience, it's a grim picture. Reform the tech or remove the tech?
Both. So, which is a frustrating thing. And as a historian, you know, I'm going to drive people crazy because I don't have an itemized list of all the things to fix. Most of this is an us problem. So we we're very concerned about what a lot of this stuff has done to kids, and that's good. And there actually is a lot of legislation, bipartisan legislation out there right now, trying to find a way to, you know, have real social media age limits, things like that. Those are all for the good. What I'm talking about is the choices we make in our personal lives, in our family lives, and in our community lives. We have to now actively resist this. It is the norm. If you don't say no to the tech will be there. Think about every public space, every concert you go to, and it's all there. So what's been really heartening to me is to see the people who resist in a thoughtful way. So a musician or a comedian or a performer who says, in my space, when I perform, everybody puts their phones away. And if you buy a ticket, that's the price of admission. And how much different that experience is for the audience, for the performer. To teachers who say, you know what, we're going to spend more time teaching handwriting because it forces you to slow down and it's an important skill. And to the schools that say no cell phones during school hours, that's great. So all of these choices have to be made now. We used to just, because the default will always be technology. And that's where I sort of end the book by saying, choose the human thing. What is the most human way of doing this? What brings out the best in our nature and what doesn't? And sometimes we'll choose the technology. It will help us do something. And that's great. But we have to make that critical choice at the beginning rather than just assuming the technology is an improvement, because not every new thing is an improvement.
Whether they're in favor of the new technology or not, some people would argue we're too far gone. What do you say to that?
I think that there's truth in that, unfortunately. And I think, but I will say I see a lot of hope in this rising generation, the Gen Zers. So they have seen, they obviously are raised with all this, but what they saw were the millennials and actually some of their boomer grandparents just kind of ruining some of these spaces with their behavior. And they're a little bit more skeptical and cynical about what it's doing to them. Does that mean they're going to resist it entirely? No. But what I hope it encourages them to do, they're also very skeptical of power in that healthy young person way. I hope that they start to build their own things, whether that's platforms that actually have more enforceable rules about behavior, whether that's design choices for new technologies that understand that you don't want to reward people's fear and anger and anxiety. I do have hope because they are not happy. They know they're not happy, and they are grateful when they're put in a situation where they're forced to leave their phones aside. I've seen it time and time again. So in that sense, I hope that their skepticism encourages them to be more creative about finding solutions and doesn't lead to nihilism about being able to change at all.
In the book, you talk about a lot of particular possible reforms, but as you say, it starts with us in some ways, ends with us. For the parents and grandparents, the aunts and uncles who are listening now, what's one really practical thing they can do in their lives, their families' lives?
So this is going to sound silly, but try it, and hopefully it's an awareness building tool, I guess they would call it. And I do it myself, and I put this test to myself when I was working on the book. Try to go one day, and never pick up your phone during brief moments of waiting or interstitial time. So while you're the first one at your meeting at work, nobody else is there. Don't pick up your phone. Look around, read a book, like do something else that isn't phone-based. When you're stuck in traffic in your car, when you're anywhere, I think if you go for a day, you'll be shocked. I know I was at how often you reach for that phone. It fills those moments. And when you no longer use that, amazing things can happen. Now, you'll be bored, which is a terrible feeling, but is also good for your brain. Your mind will wander. You might think of something that you'd forgotten earlier. You look around and see other people. You actually have to notice and feel your physical body and how you feel at that moment. These are all important things that we should be doing, and that phone lets us escape those feelings. Sometimes that's fine, but a lot of the time we actually shouldn't be trying to escape them. We should be noticing and feeling.
Fantastic. Restore our human experience and our human connection.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, the book is Extinction of Experience, Being Human in a Disconnected World. Our guest today is Christine Rosen. What a fascinating, insightful, ultimately, I think, hopeful discussion today. Christine, thanks for joining us on The American Idea.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.